We're going to read from 2 Chronicles 17, verses 1 to 10, and then Millie will read from 2 Chronicles 18. 2 Chronicles 17. Jehoshaphat, his son, succeeded him as king and strengthened himself against Israel. He stationed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah, and put garrisons in Judah and in the towns of Ephraim that his father Asa had captured. The Lord was with Jehoshaphat, because in his early years he walked in the ways that his father David had followed. He did not consult the Baals, but sought the God of his father and followed his commands rather than the practices of Israel. The Lord established the kingdom under his control, and all Judah brought gifts to Jehoshaphat, so that he had great wealth and honor. His heart was devoted to the ways of the Lord. Furthermore, he removed the high places and the Asherah poles from Judah. In the third year of his reign, he sent his officials, Ben-Hail, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nethanel, and Micaiah, to teach in the towns of Judah. With them were certain Levites, Shemaiah, Nethaniah, Zebadiah, Esahel, Shemiramoth, Jehonathan, Adonijah, Tobijah, and Tob-Adonijah, and the priests Elishama and Jehoram. They taught throughout Judah, taking with them the book of the law of the Lord, and they went round to all the towns of Judah and taught the people. The fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the lands surrounding Judah, so that they did not make war with Jehoshaphat. Now Millie will be reading from 2 Chronicles 18.
The first part of the reading will be 2 Chronicles 18, verses 1 to 8. And it reads, "Now Jehoshaphat had great wealth and honor, and he allied himself with Ahab by marriage. Some years later, he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria. Ahab slaughtered many sheep and cattle for him, and the people with him, and urged him to attack Ramoth Gilead. Ahab, king of Israel, asked Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, 'Will you go with me against Ramoth Gilead?' Jehoshaphat replied, 'I am as you are, and my people as your people. We will join you in the war.' But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, 'First seek the counsel of the Lord.' So the king of Israel brought together the prophets, 400 men, and asked them, 'Shall we go to war against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I refrain?' 'Go,' they answered, 'for God will give it into the king's hands.' But Jehoshaphat asked, 'Is there not a prophet of the Lord here whom we can inquire of?' The king of Israel answered Jehoshaphat, 'There is still one man through whom we can inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he never prophesies anything good about me, but always bad. He is Micaiah, son of Imlah.' 'The king should not say that,' Jehoshaphat replied. So the king of Israel called one of his officials and said, 'Bring Micaiah, son of Imlah, at once.'" We're now going to be reading from verses 14 to 22. "When he arrived, the king asked him, 'Micaiah, shall we go to war against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I refrain?' 'Attack and be victorious,' he answered, 'for they will be given into your hand.' The king said to him, 'How many times must I make you swear to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?' Then Micaiah answered, 'I saw all Israel scattered on the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And the Lord said, "These people have no master. Let each one go home in peace."' The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'Didn't I tell you that he never prophesies anything good about me, but only bad?' Micaiah continued, Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven, standing on his right and on his left. And the king said, who will entice Ahab, king of Israel, into attacking Ramoth Gilead and going to his death there? One suggested this and another that. Finally, a spirit came forward, stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. By what means, the Lord asked. I will go and be a lying spirit in the mouths of all his prophets, he said. You will succeed in enticing him, said the Lord. Go and do it. So the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouths of these prophets of yours. The Lord has decreed disaster for you. And the last verse that I'll be reading is verse 28. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up to Ramoth Gilead. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning, everybody. I hope you're well. This morning, we're going to be talking about King Jehoshaphat. We're continuing in our series looking at 2 Chronicles. And we've had a number of messages over the past few weeks looking at different... Sorry, I'm a bit distracted this morning. Did you leave this here, Sheehan? Okay, sorry. This morning we're going to be talking about... Sorry, just give me a moment. I just can't resist. Chocolate. Oh. That's so good. So this morning, we're talking about temptation, actually. I'm going to be very distracted. Could you just take those away from me? We're talking about temptation this morning, and I'm trying to give up chocolate. And I'm particularly weak when there's chocolate around me. If it's in the house, it gets eaten. So I've realized that I need to remove it from the house. I don't know if you struggle with temptation. In fact, I do know. I think we all struggle, don't we, if we're honest? Even as Christians, we struggle with temptation. And it's been no different for our kings that we've been looking at over these past few weeks. They have a choice again and again to obey God, to listen to him, to do what's right in his eyes, because he wants good for them and he wants good for the nation, or... you know, listen to other voices. Perhaps that's the gods of other nations, other kings, other influences, their emotions. I think we struggle with the same things, don't we? There's all kinds of voices out there. Our inner voices, our wants, our wills, our fleshly desires, such as mine for chocolate, but also cultural pressures and society and other people's expectations. And sometimes those come into conflict with what the Bible teaches and what God says is good for us. We make life harder for ourselves sometimes than I think we need to, because sometimes we court temptation. Now, I don't know if you're used to this word being used in this way, courting something. We're not talking about the legal system, the courts here. We're talking about a word that's probably gone out of fashion, courting perhaps a partner that we want to marry. You know, old sort of romantic novels might talk about courtship. Giving space and time and attention to somebody or something in our lives because really we kind of want it there, maybe long term. Me having a bag of Maltesers there is me courting temptation. What I should do is give it to Sheehan or, you know, just not buy it in the shop in the first place. When we court temptation, things that God says aren't good for us, when we perhaps have an arrogance, I can resist, it's okay to have it around, we're in danger of giving into that temptation, and we're more likely to give into it. Jesus understood the difficulty of temptation. We know this because after he was baptized, he was tempted for 40 days and nights by the enemy in the desert. He knew what it was to be tempted. And he also knew the seriousness of giving in to temptation and sinning. Because as we'll remember later at the communion table as we come to it, He paid the price for that sin, his very life on the cross. And so, when he's talking to his disciples and those listening to him, he asserts that we should do our best to avoid temptation at all costs. We can't get rid of temptation. We've always got an enemy. But equally, we do have a choice sometimes. If we know we have a weakness, like mine for chocolate, we can go to some lengths to practically remove those things from our lives. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 30, if your right hand, this one, causes you to stumble, in other words, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body, something temporal that's going to have a maybe painful now, painful for me to give that chocolate away. There may be some pain now, but it's better to do that than lose your whole body and go to hell. In other words, have some much more serious consequences that will last forever. Temptation is serious, and we shouldn't be complacent about it, and we shouldn't treat it casually. So these past few weeks, we've been looking at different kings. And as Chris Wigram spoke last week, he reminded us that in the life of this kingdom, of the United Kingdom of Israel, there had been a split between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And our story now, through the kings we're following in 2 Chronicles, follow the southern kingdom of Judah. And we're looking today at King Jehoshaphat. He was the son of King Asa, who Chris talked about last week. His forefathers had courted temptation. God had said, don't marry foreign wives with their other gods, don't worship them. And yet, time and time again, they'd compromise with these foreign gods, these foreign nations, these foreign women. Will King Jehoshaphat be any different? What do we think? Well, he starts his reign rather well. 2 Chronicles 17, verse 3, we read that the Lord was with him because he followed the ways of his father, David, that's King David, his great-great-great-whatever grandfather. He didn't consult the Baals. Baals were idols that were worshipped by a lot of the nations around them. And the northern kingdom of Israel, which was under King Ahab, had turned to Baal. But sought God of his father and followed his commands rather than the practices of Israel. That's a really good start, isn't it? He's focused on God. And this was more than just a personal faith, because we read then in verse 9 of Chronicles chapter 17 that he appoints officials and he appoints the Levites, that religious tribe whose God-given role was to teach the people how to be in right relationship with God and sort of be that connection between God and the people. He appoints them to go out all around Judah. And we read here, they taught throughout Judah, taking with them the book of the law, the Old Testament text that they had, the Ten Commandments, and they were teaching the people, reminding them of the importance of honoring God and teaching them how they can be in that right relationship with him. And so we read, as a result of this, God blesses them. And if you read chapter 17, verses 10 through to 19, it talks about all the great blessings. To summarize, the nation and the king gain respect and honor from the nations around them. They secure wealth, they secure military strength, and they have peace. Verse 10, the fear of the Lord fell on all the kingdoms of the land surrounding Judah, so they did not go to war against Jehoshaphat. And this shows that this king, Jehoshaphat, was humble, because people didn't look at that nation and say, isn't he a great king? Or didn't look at his army and say, we're going to have peace with him because he's so powerful. He looked at them and said, their God is great. And fear of the Lord fell on them. And as a result, we read in verse 5 of chapter 17, it was God who established the kingdom under his control. It wasn't Jehoshaphat. It was God. That's great, isn't it? So far, so good, and so godly. Jehoshaphat's got off to a great start. But there's a problem. And I'm going to suggest that problem at its heart is that he courts temptation. He risks turning away from God by allowing something that's been a danger to his forefathers before, leading them astray, he brings that onto himself. You see, the southern kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel, had a difficult relationship. At different points in history, they're at war with each other. At other points, they're cooperating with each other. And in 2 Chronicles 18, verse 1, we read that Jehoshaphat, and we had it read for us this morning. Thank you, Millie and Sheehan, for your reading. They form an alliance with King Ahab through marriage. So Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram, marries Ahab's daughter, Athaliah. Why? Probably a political move. Good strategy. Been done throughout history. Kings and nations, there's marriage between the families, and it cements peace and partnership. So it's probably a political move. But as we've read in previous weeks, there's some clear mandate from God about things that God's people should and shouldn't do. And if you look later in Exodus 34, verse 10 to 17, he has some strong words for the people as they're going into the promised land. He says, "You are forbidden from marrying the foreign tribes, the people of the foreign tribes." Not because God has an issue with ethnicities mixing. He goes on. He says, because they aren't worshipping the one true God. They're worshipping idols. Now, the northern kingdom and southern kingdom are God's people. They are all part of the 12 tribes. So you might say it's not marrying a foreign nation. But he is allying himself with a pagan nation. So who is this King Ahab? 1 Kings 16, verse 30, tells us a little bit about him. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And she and her nation were idol worshippers. They worshipped the god Baal. And he began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. So here we see a man who has proven that when you court temptation, it increases the likelihood that you're going to give in to that temptation. He married this lady, Jezebel, and she brought her gods with her, and it led the whole nation astray. He courted temptation and turned away from the Lord. And now Jehoshaphat is risking doing the same by allying himself with this nation. Why did he do it? Political, maybe. Maybe he thought, I can resist this temptation. I'm rooted in the one true God. We don't know. From this alliance comes a request from Ahab. Come, let's go to war against the Arameans who rule Ramoth-Gilead, a border town of some strategic importance on the border of Israel. Wisely, Jehoshaphat says, let's seek the Lord on this. And then we have this interesting account. This interesting account of the prophets and seeking the Lord and seeking the voice of the prophets. Ahab gathers together 400 prophets from Israel. But it's clear that they don't worship the one true God. Because Jehoshaphat says in verse 6 of 2 Chronicles 18, is there no longer a prophet of the Lord here in Israel whom we can inquire of? And the king gives this really interesting and almost funny answer, but shocking. There is still one prophet through whom we can inquire of the Lord, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, but always bad. He is Micaiah, son of Imlah. And here we have a prophet, we have a king who's clearly turned his back on God. He wants prophets to affirm what he wants to do. And if they don't, that's it. I'm not interested. But Jehoshaphat reprimands him, says you shouldn't say that about a prophet of God. And so Micaiah is called. And then we have this interesting account where Micaiah joins in with the 400 prophets who said, go to war, you'll have victory. And he says the same thing. But it's clear he's saying it in a sarcastic way because King Ahab straight away says, tell me the truth. He knows that he's lying. He's being facetious. And then we have God's words through his prophet. I saw all Israel scattered on the hills like sheep without a shepherd. And the Lord said, these people have no master. Let each one of them go home. Why were the people scattered? Because they were going to be defeated. Why were they like sheep without a shepherd? Because the king, King Ahab, was going to die if he goes ahead with this. And then he says, so let them go home in peace. Don't go to war. This is an appeal from God, a warning. Unsurprisingly, Ahab ignores it. We know his opinion of God's prophets already. But what about Jehoshaphat? What will he do? He's the one who, credit to him, said, let's seek the Lord. He's heard from the Lord now. 2 Chronicles 18:28. So the king of Israel, Ahab, and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth Gilead. He sided with Ahab rather than God. Why? Doesn't make sense, does it? We're not really given a clear reason. I'm going to suggest to you that it could have been because of political pressure. Their children are married together. Can you imagine the family meals and stuff when they get together? How awkward that would be. Well, you kind of disunity between those two united families. Political pressure. There was a reason that he went into partnership with him in the first place. He obviously saw some benefit from himself and the nation. Perhaps Ahab was charismatic and persuasive. Perhaps it was because of the prophets. I mean, yeah, Micaiah is God's prophet, but he's one. One voice contradicting 400 other prophets who are unanimously saying, go, it will be fine. I'm going to suggest at the heart of the reason is he courted temptation. Had he not entered into this unwise relationship with Ahab, gods worshipped of that nation were pagan gods, he wouldn't have been in this position in the first place. He wouldn't have been under political pressure to go ahead anyway, despite God saying the other. He wouldn't have had this voice of all these other false prophets to work through and challenge him. Whatever the reasons, he rebels against God. He heads off to war with Ahab, and Micaiah's prophecy comes to pass. And the coalition is defeated. Ahab is killed. You can read that in chapter 18, verse 33. What of Jehoshaphat? Verse 31. When the chariot commanders saw Jehoshaphat, they thought, this is the king of Israel. They thought he was Ahab. So they turned to attack him. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God drew them away from him. Jehoshaphat narrowly escapes with his life. So he's courted temptation. He's given in to temptation. He's turned away from the Lord. And yet the Lord protects him when he calls out to him. He seems to have got off lightly. But did he? He nearly died. That must have been frightening. I'm sure many of his soldiers who went to war with him died or were injured. And we have these strong words from the prophet Jehu, from God. Chapter 19, verse 2. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? In other words, why have you sided with Ahab who hates God? Because of this, the wrath of the Lord is on you. Doesn't mean it's done and dusted. He's still angry. There are going to be more consequences unless you turn back to me. But God knows the heart of the man. So there's hope. He says, there is, however, some good in you, for you have rid the land of the Asherah poles. These were trees, wood, for worshipping the god, the idol, Asherah. He says, you've removed them and have set your heart on seeking the Lord. Is he going to learn from his lesson? He's courted temptation, and it's led to giving in to that temptation, sinning, rebellion against God, and folly. This is God's discipline on him, and there's a chance for him to learn from that. Has he learned from his mistakes? Yes. Yes, he has. Verse 4 of chapter 19, Jehoshaphat lived in Jerusalem, and he went out again among the people from Beersheba to the hill country of Ephraim and turned them back to the Lord, the God of their ancestors. Now let's just compare this to what we read at the start, where he started off so well. He's already been out. He's turned people to God. People's hearts are on the Lord. And somehow we've got to this point where they need turning back to the Lord again. That coincides with this period where he has been compromising. He has been courting temptation. His choice as a leader of his people to, you know, court temptation and turn against God and listen to the voice of other kings who are worshipping other idols and allow that in the land has not just affected his walk with the Lord, but those around him. But the good news is that he's busy now turning people back to the Lord. And so again, we see him appointing people and sending them out, judges and Levites, to turn the people back to the Lord. He says to the judges, verse 6, consider carefully what you do, because you're not judging for mere mortals. You're not here to judge on my behalf, he's saying, but for the Lord, who is with you whenever you give a verdict. He is bringing it back to the Lord. It's not about me, he says. It's not about what I want. It's not about what other gods want, other influences. It's the one true God. And then to the Levites, he says, you are to warn the people not to sin against the Lord. Otherwise, his, that's God's wrath, will come on you and your people. He's excising temptation. He's removing the idol worship, the temptation. He's taking the bag of chocolate away. So when war comes again, the prospect of conflict, is he going to turn to other gods? Is he going to look to his military strength? Is he going to look to his partnership with the northern kingdom of Israel? Well, we see an army amass of Moabites, Ammonites, mountain people from Seir, a massive army to attack. Alarmed, Jehoshaphat resolved to inquire of the Lord and proclaimed a fast for all. The people of Judah came together to seek him. To seek help from the Lord, and indeed they came from every town in Judah to seek him. They turned to the Lord. That's their first thought. There's no looking around. There's no hearing from the Lord and then deciding not to follow through with it. Because from here, well, they take God's word and trust it and obey. God says to them, verse 15, and that should say chapter 20, I apologize. He says, do not be afraid or discouraged because of this vast army, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow march down against them. You will not have to fight this battle. Take up your position, stand firm, see the deliverance the Lord will give you. And what's remarkable here is they trust him. They obey. Because they haven't courted temptation, there's no question of looking elsewhere for their help. They trust God to the point where they don't go out like an army ready to fight and form battle lines. They go out singing like a choir. And they don't go to where they're going to strategically plan their battle lines. They trust God and go to a viewpoint where he's told them to go. And do you know what they see when they look down from that viewpoint? They see three armies dead before them. We read in this passage, and go back and look at it later, 2 Chronicles chapter 20. When they are singing to the Lord and they are marching on their way to this viewpoint, God, in a supernatural way, causes confusion on these armies. And they see themselves as the enemy, and they kill each other. And just as God said, you won't have to lift a sword. God delivers the people. Isn't that wonderful? So has Jehoshaphat learned from his mistakes? Yes, he has, but no, he hasn't. And it ends in a strange way, chapter 20. It sort of closes out his life quite briefly. And it ends on a bit of a downer. 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 32. Jehoshaphat followed the ways of his father Asa and didn't stray from them. That's good. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Fantastic. The high places, however, these are places of idol worship, were not removed. The people had still not set their hearts on the gods of their ancestors. That's the Homer Simpson dull moment. Really? Haven't you learned? Come on. He's allowing compromise in again. Where does it lead? Unsurprisingly, as we close this out, he approaches King Ahaziah. This is the son of Ahab of Israel. And they agree to go into business together, to build some trading ships and have a sort of international trading enterprise together. Back into bed with this idol-worshipping nation and king. Because you have made an alliance with Ahaziah, the Lord will destroy what you have made. The ships were wrecked and were not able to set sail to trade. So much faith sandwiched between so much failure. And at the heart of the problem is this foolishness in courting temptation. Had he trusted God, has he stepped away, had he not become complacent and allowed these things that he knew were areas of weakness in his life and the life of the nation, how much easier would it have been for him to not disobey God? And how much better for the nation and him would it have been? It's easy for us to judge him harshly, but in our Christian life, do we not all have periods where we walk strongly with the Lord, where we resist temptation well, and other times where we feel distant from God, we're rebellious, we're sinful, if we're honest, we court temptation? I don't know what weaknesses you have in your life. We can't get rid of temptation, but we can distance ourselves from it in some cases. Perhaps it's gossip. You know, hanging around the coffee machine, that's where all the good gossip is, and you linger around there at work. Perhaps it's money and your attitude to money and wealth and an addiction to shopping and finding things, and perhaps it's pornography. Could be many things. Are we courting temptation? Are we making efforts to resist, to remove those things from our lives? So as we close, what can we learn from Jehoshaphat that can help us? Firstly, recognize we all make mistakes. But we can always repent and we can learn from them. Jehoshaphat wasn't so good at learning from them. Are we better? The good news is if we repent, God forgives, God restores, God heals. No one is immune to temptation. None of us. So don't court it. Don't risk it. Don't go near it. That's what Jesus would say. Cut off that hand if it's going to cause you to sin. Remove that thing from your life. And finally, King Jehoshaphat was a king. Yeah, he was representing God to his people. You may be representing God to your family as a parent, or to your friends, your peers at school, or in the workplace, your community roles. Maybe you don't have any such roles, but we are all, if you're Christian, representatives of God. And how we choose to deal with temptation, whether we caught it or not, and how we respond to sin, that impacts others, and they may well do likewise. So I close by saying, what is God saying to you today? Thank you.